My name's Wayne Butler. I'm an alcoholic.
Wayne.
Good to be here. Grateful to be sober. Love AA. Well done, Grasshopper. Christy, where are you at? Thank you for inviting me to come and welcoming us, meeting us out the curb. I just spent an entire weekend at a convention, and I never did meet my host. I was kind of hostless. And I've had like five people meet me outside there. And a couple of them had to comment on my suit. I know how you are. It's like, this is the only place where people say, why are you dressed up like that? This is the only place they do that. It's the strangest damn thing I've ever seen in my life. Just because I look good, that's why. Happy birthday to all you birthday people. Hope you keep coming back. New people, you guys in your first 30, raise your hand again, first 30 days. First year. Welcome to AA. I'm sorry it's come to this. Could be a lot worse. My sobriety date is 8th of November, 1977. I've had no booze, pills, powders, potions, or lotions that affect me from the neck up from that day to this. I do have a history of dating mind and mood altering women, but that's a whole
yeah.
Just to give you a clue, I've been psychiatrically institutionalized 17 times, 14 times, I beg your pardon. 14 times in Watertown Insane Asylum and 3 times in the Franciscan Mental Health Center, 17 times total. Watertown Insane Asylum is for the criminally insane. I've been diagnosed 21 diagnoses, including psychopath. That was my last diagnosis. And when I was in the Watertown Insane Asylum, I self-signed in 4 times because that's where my girlfriend lived. That's a true story. Joyce, her nickname was Sybil. She was a diagnosed sociopath. She murdered her entire family. And she got educated to the Watertown Insane Asylum. She never left. She died in there. But when I met her and she told me her story, sociopath, and I told her mine, psychopath, it was love. I didn't know about love and restraints till I met her. Don't judge me. I'm the one in restraints. She took advantage of me. So now you got an idea where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
I love to drink. I do. Budweiser. King of beers. Anybody else? Anybody else like Budweiser?
Yeah.
Let me tell you how much I love Budweiser and how much I miss it 46 years and a few months later. I go out to the valley a lot, you know, when I go carry the message out in the valley and beyond. How many of you have been out to 405 North outside Los Angeles and you get on the other side of the hill and you get across the 101 freeway and about 300 yards north of the 101 exchange is Roscoe Boulevard exit. And on the west side of the freeway at the Roscoe Boulevard exit is the Anheuser-Busch Brewery. I swear before God, when I drive down there, I often stop and take a moment of silence. Strange, you might think. God, I love Budweiser. It's terrible tasting stuff. So what's that all about? Anyway, you know, it's like I was baffled. Any of you, were you baffled by this thing? It's baffling. Bill wrote alcohol, not disease. He wrote alcohol. Cunning, baffling, and powerful. And then I'll be damned if it ain't. It baffled me. I know the science of alcohol. I don't care what the money changers try to tell you. Alcohol is not addictive by nature. It's not. 9 out of 10 people can drink safely. I know I arrested a whole bunch of them. I love getting drunks in my backseat of my squad car. Don't judge me. I didn't arrest none of you. I know that for a fact. Don't do transference on my ass. I just, I'd get in my back seat and I'd 12-step them all the way to jail. I'd tell them my story.
Yeah.
I had this one guy in the back seat of my squad car and face down in the seat way. I heard this voice, will you shut up and lock me up? I became his sponsor. But there's more of a story to that than what meets the eye. I was 10 years sober when I became a cop, and there's a story about that. But let me tell you something. I come from an alcoholic home. Due to limited time, there's a lot that I would like to tell you that I can't. I just don't want to take that much time. But I want to tell you something. A lot of things happened to me as a kid that shouldn't happen to me as a kid. Growing up in an alcoholic home was just torture. And I'm not playing the victim card. When I share something, wherever I go in Alcoholics Anonymous, I always tell them this, and I'm going to tell you this, is that whatever I share with you, I want you to know I've recovered from, or I wouldn't share it here. I'm not bringing my BS to these tables and dumping it on you, and then walking out of here and feeling better for a half an hour and having made you miserable. My sponsor made me make a deal with him. He says, "You bring your problems to me, we'll step our way through it, and then we'll take that to the meeting." And I'm so glad he taught me that because I'm a whiner. My nickname was Wainer the Whiner. And that used to piss me off. And I really had trouble. I really had a troubled childhood. I had a lot of victimization for real, but I've learned that victims don't get to stay sober in AA because we're so busy. Where are you going? I don't get to go nowhere. Bring me a cup. No, never mind. Bring me coffee, but I remember it's out. Oh, where was I now? Victim. If you look closely, you can see a victim, a V right here on my forehead. Victims don't get to stay sober because we're so busy living in the pain of the past and the fear of the future that we cannot have a now. And the now is the most important part about Alcoholics Anonymous, I think, the now, the right now. Because right now, right here, is that for me? You're my timer, aren't you? Go ahead and leave. I'll just keep right on talking. Slacker. I love AA, don't you? Can't get away with this kind of crap nowhere else. I shoot you. And so I'm not a victim anymore. I've got challenges. I don't have problems. That took a while in sobriety to learn that. And I want you new guys to know that the road that our predecessors here in AA paved for us is unmistakably clear if you look at towards the spirituality of life. And I didn't believe that when I first came here. This was Lanesville. I mean, it's like, oh my God, it's come to this. I got sober in Illinois. What was that?
You're good.
I see this fellow with a big beard and a lot of tattoos on this picture here. Remind me of someone that I put in my car. I'll say that because he's way over there and I'm way over here. I was in an alcoholic home. It was really trying. When I was 9 years old, I was walking home from school. I was raised on in farmland. And in those days, you got home when you're to be at home when the light street light went out. That was just it. And we didn't need any safeguards. Nothing was really happening. But then something happened to me when I was walking home from school. This fella ripped me off of the street. I was walking home alone, and he locked me in the coal bin of his basement, and he tortured me for 3 days from Friday to Monday. He raped my little body. He put things in my body. He cut me. He hurt me really bad. And on Monday morning, he threw me out in the street naked, told me if I told my family, the police, or anybody who it was and where it was, he'd kill my family and me. So I carried that with me until I did my first fifth step. I want you to know the power of the fifth step. All kinds of human powers tried to fix that for me mentally, emotionally, and they couldn't touch it. They put pills, powders, potions, and lotions down my throat trying to fix that. But what they didn't give me was Budweiser.
Yes.
Had they done that, I don't know if I'd be here today. I don't know. Maybe it's by God's grace. I don't know. And I share that story not as drama, but I know other people. I sponsor a lot of alcoholics who all have similar experience to mine. That's why they asked me to sponsor them many times. And I'm not talking about that young lady. I'm talking about many of my sponsees have had those events in their life, and they asked me to sponsor them because of my experience. And it's a very challenging thing to know that what happened to me happened to them in their own way. That doesn't make me alcoholic. But I tell you what it does do. It feeds part of alcoholism. And I want to talk about that. I want to first tell you, is there a big book? Who's got a big book? I knew she had a big book. Good baby. Good baby. Here's what makes me alcoholic. You can find it on page 44. Because I can go into all kinds of stories, but that doesn't necessarily make me alcoholic. You know, lots of things that often get called alcoholism, they're not. We can talk about how much we drank or what we did when we drank. And that's not always an indicator of alcoholism. That's why it's so hard for the diagnosis of this condition for us to have, because the truth of the matter is half the people in this room may not be sober a year from now. Those are the statistics. And it surprised me what makes me alcoholic. How many of you have taken the John Hopkins 20 questions test? Okay, it may have helped you, so I'm not bad-mouthing it, but it's the dumbest test I've ever seen. And I'm going to tell you why. They put the quantification of the exam at the bottom, so you see it. And I'm going to read a header. So when I was given that yellow card with these 20 questions, I went right to the bottom to see what was happening. And it says, if you say yes to one, you might be alcoholic. One. If you answer yes to two, you're probably alcoholic. If you answer yes to three or more, you're definitely alcoholic. So I know they're not getting three. I don't care what's on the test. Well, one of the things we're taught to do in AA, depending on who your sponsor is a lot of the statements get turned into questions because it's more applicable that way. And here's what makes me alcoholic, and it's stunning. So on page 44, and I'm putting in the first person, it says, if when I honestly want to, do I find I cannot quit drinking entirely? You know, when it's just me and the mirror, I can't lie my way out of that one. I have wanted to quit so many times. I've tried to quit drinking to save my marriages. I tried to quit drinking to save my career in the Navy. The most important thing to me was the military. I served honorably. It's just I'd get drinking and I'd forget where the ship was. And then they leave without me. They frown on that. I love the United States Navy. I did. I found structure. I found order to my life until I picked up a drink. Strangest thing. Went to Vietnam a couple of times, had honorable service, received several awards, several medals for my service. I planned on making the military a career, and then I drank. And my drinking took me right out of the United States Navy and the shame that walked off that ship with me. I can't quit drinking when I want to. When I honestly want to, I can't stay quit. That's question one. This is not looking good. Question two, or with drinking, do I have little control of the amount I take? This is getting bad. You see, I know for a fact once I take a drink, I don't know what's going to happen. I can make up all kinds of rationalizations, but once I take that first drink, I can't predict when I'll stop, what's going to happen when I do stop. And the power of alcohol in my mind and my psyche is so powerful that it makes the consequences of my drinking inconsequential. You cannot scare me into not drinking. And many people have tried. So that's two yeses already. And I'm thinking, one more, I'm screwed. There ain't no more. Then it says, you are probably alcoholic. And I went like this. That was close. Probably alcoholic. I just want you newcomers to know that most of us who die drunk and loaded, we die between probably and definitely. For whatever reason, we don't quite get to definitely alcoholic. See, when I raised my hand in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and I said, I'm Wayne, I'm an alcoholic, that's just an admission. I'm just saying it. There's no depth and weight behind that. It's a beginning. It's necessary. It's a beginning. It's the entry into AA, but it's just that. I have to somehow be moved from that admission to acceptance. And I often say I'd like to tell you where it happened to me so you would know, but no, I don't want to do that because then you would identify and you'd be done. See, I don't know where I went from probably to definitely. Somewhere in my first 100 meetings, somewhere during the first round through my 12 steps, somewhere in that first 100 speakers I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous doing what I'm doing, what Diana did. Somewhere we're making that terrible coffee. I made terrible coffee because I didn't want the job. So I made coffee that would make the Navy stutter. You know what them old surly old timers did? Old Curly, he come up and got a cup of my coffee. I wanted out of the job. He come up and took the sip right from me. Goes like this. That's really some stout coffee. Good job, kid. I thought, I can get fired from a job, but I can't get fired from making coffee. So AA screwed up. I'll tell you, I had problems. I was a weird kid. You know, when you live in an alcoholic home, you're going to get weird. I was weird. I was biting people. I was eating crayons. I sit in the class in my little desk chair. You know, that little, remember that one you can't hardly get out of? I'd get out of it and run headfirst into the wall for no good reason. Just because it was there. They called me the kid that wore a helmet and didn't ride a bike. I got nicknamed Lil Wayne. Yeah, I heard someone took that name. You know, I talked about that when I spoke Saturday night at the convention. I talked about my nickname. And this fella who happens to be black, he comes up to me this morning at the Sunday morning closing, and he's wearing a Lil Wayne t-shirt. And he said, "They're here." I said, "I love this guy. I love that guy." And the brutality of that alcoholic home. When I was 10 years old, my father, this is disgusting and hard to say and hard to hear. So I hope you'll hold judgment until I finish. I want to remind you, I won't share anything I haven't recovered from. My dad was a truck driver out of Chicago. He was a Teamsters Union steward. He worked for a guy named Jimmy Hoffa. My dad was a tough guy. He was one of his 10 right-hand guys. And he wanted me to be a tough guy, and I wrote poetry. He says, quote, "We'll have no queers in this house." And I thought, what's that? I didn't even know what he was talking about, but I knew it wasn't good. Tried to beat that out of me. And then when I was 10 years old, he took me on a tour through the South. He drove through the South, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Arkansas. And he belonged to this outfit that burned crosses and wore funky outfits. And at the age of 10, he decided to groom me in. When we got to that bonfire meeting with all these people running around with those funky looking outfits on, they had a junior outfit for me ready. I thought it was cool. I asked my dad if I could work at school. He said, no. We share what we used to be like here, don't we, in a general way. We share what we used to be like. And I'm gonna go to this now so I can get it out of the way before I run out of time, because I want you to know the solution. When I came to you in 1972 for the first time, what I used to be like was I was a stone-cold racist, bigot, prejudiced to the core. I was a wife beater, a child abuser, and an animal abuser. That's what I was. I was a son of a bitch. That's what I was when I got here. And the only thing that gave me any peace and solace was Budweiser. I became a very violent man. I enjoyed inflicting pain on people. I'm not a tough guy. I wouldn't stand there and fight you. I'd come up from behind you and knock you out, and then I'd torture you. That's what I was when I got here. That's what I was like when I got here. And the people in my hometown knew it. I wasn't welcome anywhere. You want to know how I got over that? I'm going to share that right now. How many of you got sponsors? How many of you don't have sponsors? Be honest. How many of you don't have sponsors? Get one, please, before you leave tonight. And I want to tell you how I recovered. When I was 3 months sober in February of 1978, Charles, a black man, came up to me and asked me if I'd sponsor him. And I took that 357 out of my boot and put it right in his face. And I said, "Get away from me." And I called him names. I got home that night and I got a phone call from my sponsor. "Heard you told Charles you wouldn't sponsor him." I said, "You heard my fifth step. You know I can't sponsor him. And you know why I can't sponsor him." He said, "Listen, kid." Naturally, he said, "Dummy." He says, "Are you aware that nobody in AA in these quad cities like you? Are you aware there's a group conscience meeting this Sunday to kick you out?" I said, "Yeah, so much for your love and tolerance." And then he says, "And are you aware that you have to have a sponsor to stay sober?" I had become convinced that was the truth because the old timers told me I can't stay sober without a sponsor. And I said, "Yeah, that's what I hear." He says, are you aware that I am the only alcoholic in the Quad Cities of Illinois that will sponsor you?" He said, "Here's what you're going to do. You're going to go home. You're going to call Charles. You're going to apologize to him. You're going to give him your word. You will never use that word ever again as long as you live. And that if he'd still have you sponsor him, you'd be happy to. And he says, that if you don't do that, I'll have nothing more to do with you. Click. I'm a desperate alcoholic. I don't want to drink no more. So I called Charles. Knowing he would tell me to go straight to hell. Wouldn't you? So I've got hope that he will. So I do what Barney tells me to do. Charles starts crying. He's overwhelmed that I apologized. And then he says, I would really want you to be my sponsor. And I thought, well, that didn't work. 3 months later, this 6 foot tall lesbian came up to me and poked me in the chest, said, you're going to sponsor me. And I said, the hell I am. Get on your kickstand and ride your ass out of here. Got a phone call that night. It's my sponsor. Heard you told Joyce you wouldn't sponsor her. Same thing. Called up Joyce. She loved the. She made sure she sucked every ounce of energy out of me getting her apology. And then she says, I told you were going to sponsor me, bitch. And then Adam, the Jewish fellow, asked me to sponsor him, and it just went bad. Same thing. That happened 6 more times in my first 2 years of sobriety. And then I found out my sponsor was sending them to me. I didn't think that was a damn bit funny. Folks, that's why sponsorship is so invaluable. My sponsor heard my fifth step, and he knew that all the human powers of medicine, psychiatry, psychology, sociology, theology, pharmacology, and talk therapy all tried to relieve me of my alcoholism and the madness of my mind, and they failed utterly. They get E for effort, but they failed. Why? Because they can't study the real problem. The real problem. See, when I stopped drinking and using those psych meds that I was on, when I stopped using those, it got ugly. You know, I was arrested 9 times before I got sober on November 8th. Only twice was I drinking. See, when you don't get arrested while drinking, they don't call that alcoholism. They call that criminality for some reason. And I got arrested 7 times in AA meetings. I didn't know they could do that. When they arrested me one time, I said, you're breaking tradition. They took me anyway. This one time, I was in a meeting. My sponsor convinced me, sit in the middle of the boat. Sit in the middle of the boat. I said, what a butthead. So I'm sitting in the middle of the room to make the old buzzard happy. All of a sudden, there's some commotion at the door. I turn around and look, and there's 2 deputy sheriffs looking in the room, and they locked on me, and I thought, well, they got the right guy. Here we go. So they came into the meeting with total disregard for our format. Walked up to me, and like an idiot, I went to shake their hand. Then he put a handcuff on it. And when that handcuff hit my wrist, all hell broke loose. And we are fighting for my life. And I want to thank my home group for they got out of the way to give them room to work. And they finally got me handcuffed. And they're dragging me out of the meeting. A newcomer's holding the door open for him. And as I'm drugged by, he goes like this, keep coming back. That doesn't make me alcoholic. What makes me alcoholic is my inability to control and enjoy my drinking and drink like normal people. That's what makes me alcoholic. Excuse me. But what I want to talk about in this last 13 minutes is the ism, the damnable thing that science can't treat. Even Dr. Silkworth said so. Do you know that even Dr. Silkworth alluded to the fact the disease is arrested upon cessation of drinking and the removal of the obsession? The disease is 100% fully arrested. 100%. There's nothing out to get you, folks. Nothing wants you dead. That's all hyperbole. The disease is arrested. Dr. Silkworth says, in his opinion, that the only relief, quote, the only relief we have to suggest the men and women of science is complete abstinence. That's all they got. That's all they can treat. Remove the alcohol, and they got nothing else. But there's this ism thingy. Do you know what that ism stands for? Some people say it stands for I sponsor myself, ISM. Incredibly short memory, ISM. But I like the one that's in the big book because it set me up to have this ism thing. You see, in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's called an internal spiritual maladjustment. I would have never known this. And that maladjustment leads to a spiritual malady if it isn't resolved. My big problem is I'm maladjusted to life in full flight reality. And because of that, I became an outright mental defective. That's on page Roman numeral 26 of our big book. I discovered I'm not really psychiatric. I mean, not me. I'm not. It says it right there. I'm in full flight from the great reality on page 55, capital G, capital R. That I'm maladjusted to what life? The spiritual life. And because of that, I became an outright mental defective. My sponsor knows this stuff, so he knows what to do with me. And by sending those folks for me to sponsor, of which all but two are still alive and sober, the two that died sober. Charles married my son's mother. I officiated the wedding. It's incredible. The forgiveness thing that must take place if I'm to stay sober. I wanted him in the ground. And I turn around and officiate their wedding, for crying out loud. I did pause when it got to the part where does anybody have a problem with them getting together. I just did that to kind of tease them. There's a miracle that took place on June 10th, 1935, when Dr. Bob took his last drink. The miracle was sparked on Mother's Day, 1935. The Mother's Day event where Bill and Bob got together and spoke was going to be 15 minutes turned into 6 hours. One alcoholic talking to another. And we discovered what science can't discover, that maladjustment leads to a spiritual malady, a broken spirit, if you will. And I have to tell you, I came here with a broken spirit. There's no doubt about it. Life broke my spirit. And I reacted to it by drinking Budweiser and fine wine, like Ripple.
Yeah.
And now, I know most of you don't even know what I'm talking about. You're thinking Ripple on the ocean or something. Ripple was not a wine. It was a chemical. I swear it was a hallucinogenic. Ripple, they closed that chemical plant down. They don't make it no more. But I do like Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. Anybody else? Do you know why I like Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill? Because when I puke, it looks like I'm bleeding internally. And I tell the girls I'm dying from stomach cancer and they feel sorry for me. You guys know how you are. It's about the only way to get a date. And but they expect you to die at some point. I'm going right along. I remember I'm a projectile puker because I've got false teeth now, but I had a partial denture in me then. And I'm bowing before any other bowers before the ivory altar. Man, I was so sick. I'd been drinking Boone's Farm and Mad Dog, Cisco, Night Train, Thunderbird, you know, and I was just sick. And I blew out my denture right into the toilet. And I thought, you know, if they go down that hole at the bottom, they're gone for good. So I went in after them, and I caught them right before they put down the shooter. And I thought, what the hell? I wrenched them off and put them right back in. I sure miss drinking. I want to talk about the power of alcohol and the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've already demonstrated for you the power of Alcoholics Anonymous. I've gone from being a racist and a bigot and prejudiced, a wife beater, a child abuser, an animal abuser, to I hope a kind man who cares for people. It's out of the ordinary for a diagnosed psychopath. I was court ordered to take medication for the rest of my natural life before they would let me out of the Watertown Insane Asylum the last time. On February 13th, I walked out of my mom's house and set it on fire. I went out and blew up my dad's car, and I went to the meeting and tried to shoot my sponsor. And they locked me. They didn't put me in jail. They put me in a Watertown Insane Asylum on an indefinite lifetime commitment with my girlfriend. My My sponsor went to bat. When you're in a psych ward like that, you got no rights. You got more rights as a, in a jail than you. You can't get a lawyer because you're crazy. Your life is in the hands of a psychiatric panel. They decide when you go and when you don't. And the more you tell them you're not crazy, the more they're certain you are. My sponsor did H&I at that very institution every Tuesday and every Friday. He's the only member of AA that went to that institution. On Tuesday, he'd do a big book study. He'd do a 12 and 12 study, show a movie on Friday. And he knew all the psychiatrists there. And he went, this is the man I tried to shoot in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He went to this board of psychiatry and he talked him into letting me go home with him to give AA one more try before they put me away. And for reasons unknown to me, they let him do that. And on October 30th, 1977, they released me into Barney's custody. He took me home. I left and went and got drunk. I got drunk for seven straight days. And then on November 8th of 1977, I took what appears to be my last drink. And my life has changed. And I want to talk about this in a little bit of time I have left. So what about the power of Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, for those of you that are new, I've discovered there's three phases of 12-step development. Three phases. We all know about phase two. If you've been painstaking about this phase of our development, you will be amazed before you're halfway through. That's phase two. The three phases are desperation, restoration, and transformation. Desperation is steps one, two, and three. Folks, I wouldn't have done 90% of what I did when I finally surrendered if I wasn't desperate not to drink. I was so desperate I would do anything for my sponsor, with my sponsor. And that desperation was not lifted. They didn't hug me out of my desperation. And here's the thing that I would like to caution the newer people that are coming out of an institution. I'm not begrudging institutions or treatment centers. They're necessary in some ways. But by the time we get you from there, most of your desperation has been removed. You got three meals a day, a lot of hugs, a lot of love. Depending on where you are, you might even get yoga for all I know. But by the time we get you, you're not desperate hardly at all, and you might not be inclined to do the things we ask you to do. So I want you to be aware that that could be your case, because most of them die loaded and drunk. My desperation is what motivated me to take part two, phase two, steps four through nine, the restoration phase. And here's what I discovered is important about the restoration phase. There's a duality to that. One of my mentors in my early years, a guy by the name of Chuck Chamberlain, who's passed on now, taught me about duality in my illness. And there's a duality to steps four through nine. The first restored to soundness of mind involves alcohol, and for some of you, alcohol and drugs. Being restored to sanity means I know that under no circumstances can I drink alcohol safely. I am absolutely convinced of that. I've tried, haven't you? I've tried to do it safely, and I cannot drink safely. So restoration number one is complete. But why do I need steps four through nine? Because that's where I get restored to soundness of mind, where life is concerned, where people are concerned. I get restored to sanity through steps four through nine and prepared for the final phase, to be catapulted into the fourth dimension of existence, if you will. And that's the transformation phase, steps 10, 11, and 12. And I can't get there if I don't do steps four through nine. And that's so important, because that's where the power is, steps 10, 11, and 12. And I just want to share that with you newcomers so you know why it's so important that we go through the steps. It isn't, even if the steps four is difficult, whatever secrets you've got, this is the place to unload them with a sponsor or someone, a trusted friend. I did my first inventory with a priest because I knew he couldn't rat me out, because I had some skeletons that still had skin on them, if you know what I mean. And when I got to that four through nine, I didn't want to do it. But my sponsor said, if you don't do it, not only will you not stay sober, but you'll have a miserable time doing it. And I did steps four through nine, and I got catapulted into steps 10, 11, and 12 one day at a time. You don't have to wait till you got 5 years or 10 years. You can do it now. You get a sponsor. Thank you. You get a sponsor. You allow that sponsor to guide and direct. You know, there's an ethos to our sponsorship here I'd like to share with you. I found it through Bill's work with a guy named Father Ed Dowling. Father Ed Dowling is whom I believe saved Bill's life when he was 15 years sober. From 1947 to 1949, Father Dowling took Bill back through the 12 steps and helped him get over his lifelong depression, to have it never return before he passed away in 1971. Father Dowling in my mind, is a co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. Half the members of AA got drunk. Half of the members of the Big Book died drunk. Did you know that? Half of the stories in the back of the Big Book died drunk because they didn't keep up with steps 10, 11, and 12. And I need to know that, because why can't that happen to me? I can get drunk. My dad, God bless him, I have four members of my family that all had sobriety in AA at one time, and all four died drunk, two by suicide. I hear people say God keeps them sober, and that may be true for you, but it ain't true for me. God don't keep me sober. God has never kept me sober. That's why God gave me AA, so AA could keep me sober. So God and AA keep me sober. One without the other is insufficient. However, I also have to say this. You can have too much God, not enough AA, and die drunk. That's why sponsorship is so important. That's why having friends in AA, having people sober about as long as you are, so you talk bad about your sponsor to them. You get some buddies. You buddy up. And you make this thing work. That's what I did. It's no more complicated than that. And then the impossible happened when I was 10 years sober. The impossible. I applied for and became a police officer in Des Moines, Iowa, Polk County, Iowa. I did it for one reason, so I could 12-step alcoholics. And I got on the job. It's impossible with my history. Yet a sheriff can hire anybody he wants to, if he wants to risk his election. And he gave me a chance. And I served proudly. I was rookie of the year. I didn't abuse anybody in my squad car. Even when they crapped on my seat, I just took them to the, what we call the wet cleaners. You know, the car wash. We washed the car and them too. I ended up sponsoring 37 alcoholics that I arrested altogether. God used me. And then when that opportunity was up, I left the sheriff's department, and I was called and asked if I wanted to come to California by a Vietnam fellow friend of mine that we served together in Vietnam. And he started a bodyguard agency in California, in Los Angeles. He said, how would you like to double the money you're making as a cop? They got a new sheriff in town. He got my sheriff retired. The new sheriff didn't want me on the job. He couldn't believe I got hired. He said, I'm not taking a chance on you. So he said, I'm going to take you off the street and put you in the jail. I don't want to work in the jail. That's not where I belong. I belong on the street where I can help alcoholics. And after I was notified I was going to go to the jail, I knew I was going to resign. At the same time, my friend from Vietnam called me up and said, how would you like to come to work for me? Double the money. He said, I want you to be a bodyguard. In June of 1992, I moved to California, and I took that job on. And I want to tell you, I love that job. It gives me the free time to do my AA work. And then I got to do a little bit of television, too. I got to get involved in television. I loved doing that job, but I didn't love it as much as I do AA, because when it interfered with my AA life, I gave that up. I'm not letting nothing stand in my way of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I encourage you, you might take a look at that yourself. If you really want to stay sober over the long term. And one last thing, I'll close with this. Time matters. Time matters. It doesn't mean I've got anything better than anybody else, but time matters, because I'm 46 years sober now. And had I not done the things I did year after year after year, day after day after day, I would not be equipped to work with alcoholics the way I'm equipped to work with them, because when I work with alcoholics, they save my life. It's an interesting thing. When I'm working with Diana, what's happening is coming back to me too. It's always looking at myself when I'm working with another alcoholic. I don't ever want to forget that. I don't ever want to get so big that I have to drink and become little again. I'm just a drunk. Here's the nice thing about my home group. I got treated really special over the weekend. John knows how that works, because I'm a speaker there. So I got treated real special. It kind of could feed your ego if you let it. But when I get back to my home group Wednesday night, they're going to say, you weren't here, you were gone. They're going to act like I'm nobody. I'm just average. And that's exactly what I need to counterbalance the power and the influence of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want you newcomers to know there's an absolute power here. And this is the last thing. I have 42 seconds. You'll hear the book talk about needing a spiritual defense. And people always talk about God when they say spiritual defense, because it says there'll come a time when you're mentally defenseless. It gets first thing, your defense must come from a higher power. But what they don't tell you is your sponsor is a spiritual defense. Your homies are a spiritual defense. Your commitments are a spiritual defense. Those phone calls you make are a spiritual defense. Those are all spiritual defenses. And what I've discovered And when you can't get touch with that, like when I'm on an airplane flying to Australia and I get upgraded to first class, I'm new at this, I'm thirsty. And they're giving free drinks in first class. The flight attendant comes by. I see that. Thank you. She bends over to give me water, and her necklace falls out, a circle and triangle. And I said, can we have a meeting? And we did. That's how God operates. Is it God or is it God? Thanks for letting me share.